Chapter 9 Reaping 1 As they stepped into the stable, which was lit by one dim gas lamp, a shadow moved out of one of the stalls. Roland, who had belted on both guns, now drew them. Shimi looked at him with an uncertain smile, holding a stirrup in one hand. Then the smile broadened, his eyes flashed with happiness, and he ran toward them. Roland holstered his guns and made ready to embrace the boy, but Shimi ran past him and threw himself into Cuthbert's arms. "Whoa, whoa," Cuthbert said, first staggering back comically and then lifting Shimi off his feet. "You like to knock me over, boy."
"She got you out," Shimi cried. "Knew she would, so I did. Good old Susan."
Shimi looked around at Susan, who stood beside Roland. She was still pale, but now seemed composed. Shimi turned back to Cuthbert and planted a kiss directly in the center of Bert's forehead.
"Whoa," Bert said again. "What's that for?"
"'Cause I love you, good old Arthur Heath. You saved my life."
"Well, maybe I did," Cuthbert said, laughing in an embarrassed way. His borrowed sombrero, too large to begin with, now sat comically askew on his head. "But if we don't get a move on, I won't have saved it for long."
"Horses are all saddled," Shimi said. "Susan told me to do it, and I did. I did it just right. I just have to put this stirrup on Mr. Richard Stockworth's horse because the one on there's about worn through."
"That's a job for later," Alan said, taking the stirrup. He put it aside, then turned to Roland. "Where do we go?" Roland's first thought was that they should return to the Thorin mausoleum. Shimi reacted with instant horror.
"The boneyard? And with Demon Moon at the full?"
He shook his head so violently that his sombrero came off and his hair flew from side to side.
"They're dead in there," sighed Dearborn, "but if you tease them during the time of the demon, they's apt to get up and walk."
"It's no good anyway," Susan said. "The women of the town will be lining the way from seafront with flowers and filling the mausoleum, too. Olive will be in charge if she's able, but my aunt and Coral are apt to be in the company. Those aren't ladies we want to meet."
"All right," Roland said. "Let's mount up and ride. Think about it, Susan. You too, Shimi. We want a place where we can hide up until dawn, at least. And it should be a place we can get to in less than an hour. Off the Great Road, and in any direction from Hambry but northwest."
"Why not northwest?" Alan asked.
"Because that's where we're going now. We've got a job to do, and we're going to let them know we're doing it. Eldred Jonas, most of all." He offered a thin blade of a smile. "I want him to know the game is over. No more castles. The real gunslingers are here. Let's see if he can deal with them."
2.
An hour later, with the moon well above the trees, Roland's quartet arrived at the Sitgo oil patch. They rode out parallel to the Great Road, for safety's sake, but as it happened, the caution was wasted. They saw not one rider on the road going in either direction.
"It's as if reaping's been cancelled this year," Susan thought.
Then she thought of the red-handed stuffies and shivered. They would have painted Roland's hands red tomorrow night, and still would if they were caught.
Not just him, either. All of us. Shimi, too.
They left the horses, and Capricoso, who had trotted ill-temperedly but nimbly behind them on a tether tied to some long-dead pumping equipment in the southeastern corner of the patch, and then walked slowly toward the working derricks, which were clustered in the same area. They spoke in whispers when they spoke at all. Roland doubted if that was necessary, but whispers here seemed natural enough. To Roland, Sitgo was far spookier than the graveyard, and while he doubted that the dead in that latter place awoke, even when old Demon was full, there were some very unquiet corpses here, squalling zombies that stood rusty weird in the moonlight, with their pistons going up and down like marching feet. Roland led them into the active part of the patch nevertheless, past a sign which read, "How's your hard hat?" and another reading, "We produce oil, we refine safety." They stopped at the foot of a derrick, grinding so loudly that Roland had to shout in order to be heard.
"Shimi, give me a couple of those big bangers."
Shimi had taken a pocketful from Susan's saddlebag and now handed a pair of them over.
Roland took Bert by the arm and pulled him forward. There was a square of rusty fencing around the derrick, and when the boys tried to climb it, the horizontal snapped like old bones. They looked at each other in the running shadows, combined of machinery and moonlight, nervous and amused. Susan twitched Roland's arm. "Be careful," she shouted, over the rhythmic wompa, wompa, wompa of the derrick machinery. She didn't look frightened, he saw, only excited and alert. He grinned, pulled her forward, and kissed the lobe of her ear. "Be ready to run," he whispered. "If we do this right, there's going to be a new candle here at Sitco, a hellacious big one." He and Cuthbert ducked under the lowest strut of the rusty derrick tower and stood next to the equipment, wincing at the cacophony. Roland wondered that it hadn't torn itself apart years ago. Most of the works were housed in rusty metal blocks, but he could see a gigantic turning shaft of some kind, gleaming with oil that must be supplied by automated jets. Up this close, there was a gassy smell that reminded him of the jet that flared rhythmically on the other side of the oil patch. "Giant farts!" Cuthbert shouted. "What? I said it smells like... Ah, never mind. Let's do it if we can. Can we?" Roland didn't know. He walked toward the machinery, crying out beneath metal cowls which were painted a faded, rusting green. Bert followed with some reluctance. The two of them slid into a short aisle, smelly and baking hot, that took them almost directly beneath the derrick. Ahead of them, the shaft at the end of the piston turned steadily, shedding oily teardrops down its smooth sides. Beside it was a curved pipe, almost surely an overflow pipe, Roland thought. An occasional drop of crude oil fell from its lip, and there was a black puddle on the ground beneath. He pointed at it, and Cuthbert nodded. Shouting would do no good in here. The world was a roaring, squealing din. Roland curled one hand around his friend's neck and pulled Cuthbert's ear to his lips. He held a big bang up in front of Bert's eyes with the other. "Light it and run," he said. "I'll hold it, give you as much time as I can. That's for my benefit as much as for yours. I want a clear path back through that machinery. Do you understand?" Cuthbert nodded against Roland's lips, then turned the gunslinger's head so he could speak in the same fashion. "What if there's enough gas here to burn the air when I make a spark?" Roland stepped back, raised his palms in a how-do-I-know gesture. Cuthbert laughed and drew out a box of sulfur matches which he had scooped off Avery's desk before leaving. He asked with his eyebrows if Roland was ready. Roland nodded. The wind was blowing hard, but under the derrick the surrounding machinery cut it off, and the flame from the sulfur rose straight. Roland held out the big banger and had a momentary painful memory of his mother, how she had hated these things, how she had always been sure that he would lose an eye or a finger to one. Cuthbert tapped his chest above his heart and kissed his palm in the universal gesture of good luck. Then he touched the flame to the fuse. It began to sputter. Bert turned, pretended to bang off a covered block of machinery. That was Bert, Roland thought. He would joke on the gallows. And then dashed back down the short corridor they'd used to get here. Roland held the round firework as long as he dared, then lobbed it into the overflow pipe. He winced as he turned away, half expecting what Bert was afraid of, that the very air would explode. It didn't. He ran down the short aisle, came into the clear, and saw Cuthbert standing just outside the broken bit of fencing. Roland flapped both hands at him. "Go, you idiot, go!" And then the world blew up behind him. The sound was a deep, belching thud that seemed to shove his eardrums inward and suck the breath out of his throat. The ground rolled under his feet like a wave under a boat, and a large, warm hand planted itself in the center of his back and shoved him forward. He thought he ran with it for a step, maybe even two or three steps, and then he was lifted off his feet and hurled at the fence, where Cuthbert was no longer standing. Cuthbert was sprawled on his back, staring up at something behind Roland. The boy's eyes were wide and wondering, his mouth hung open. Roland could see all this very well, because Sitco was now as bright as in full daylight. They had lit their own reaping bonfire, it seemed, a night early and much brighter than the one in town could ever hope to be. He went skidding on his knees to where Cuthbert lay and grabbed him under one arm. From behind them came a vast, ripping roar, and now chunks of metal began to fall around them. They got up and ran toward where Alain stood in front of Susan and Shimi, trying to protect them. Roland took a quick look back over his shoulder and saw that the remains of the derrick, about half of it still stood, were glowing blackish red like a heated horseshoe around a flaring yellow torch that ran perhaps 150 feet into the sky. It was a start. He didn't know how many other derricks they could fire before folk began arriving from town, but he was determined to do as many as possible, no matter what the risks might be. Blowing up the tankers at Hanging Rock was only half the job. Farson's source had to be wiped out. Further firecrackers dropped down further overflow pipes turned out not to be necessary. There was a network of interconnected pipes under the oil patch, most filled with natural gas that had leaked in through ancient decaying seals. Roland and Cuthbert had no more than reached the others when there was a fresh explosion, and a fresh tower of flame erupted from a derrick to the right of the one they had set afire. A moment later, a third derrick, this one 60 full yards away from the first two, exploded with a dragon's roar. The ironwork tore free of its anchoring concrete pillars like a tooth pulled from a decayed gum. It rose on a cushion of blazing blue and yellow, attained a height of perhaps 70 feet, then heeled over and came crashing back down, spewing sparks in every direction. Another. Another. And yet another. The five young people stood in their corner, stunned, holding their hands up to shield their eyes from the glare. Now the oil patch flared like a birthday cake, and the heat baking toward them was enormous. "Gods be kind," Alain whispered. If they lingered here much longer, Roland realized, they would be popped like corn. There were the horses to consider, too. They were well away from the main focus of the explosions, but there was no guarantee that the focus would stay where it was. Already he saw two derricks that hadn't even been working engulfed in flames. The horses would be terrified. Hell, he was terrified. "Come on," he shouted. They ran for the horses through shifting yellow-orange brilliance. 3. At first, Jonas thought it was going on in his own head, that the explosions were part of their lovemaking. Lovemaking, yeah, lovemaking or shit. He and Coral made love no more than donkeys did sums. But it was something. Oh, yes, indeed it was. He'd been with passionate women before, ones who took you into a kind of oven place and then held you there, staring with greedy intensity as they pumped their hips. But until Carl, he'd never been with a woman that sparked such a powerfully harmonic chord in himself. With sex, he had always been the kind of man who took it when it came and forgot it when it didn't. But with Coral, he only wanted to take it, and take it some more. When they were together, they made love like cats or ferrets, twisting and hissing and clawing. They bit at each other and cursed at each other, and so far none of it was even close to enough. When he was with her, Jonas sometimes felt as if he were being fried in sweet oil. Tonight there had been a meeting with the Horsemen's Association, which had pretty much become the Farson Association in these latter days. Jonas had brought them up to date, had answered their idiotic questions, and had made sure they understood what they'd be doing the next day. With that done, he had checked on Rhea, who had been installed in Kimba Reimer's old suite. She hadn't even noticed Jonas peering in at her. She sat in Reimer's high-ceilinged, book-lined study, behind Reimer's ironwood desk, in Reimer's upholstered chair, looking as out of place as a whore's bloomers on a church altar. On Reimer's desk was the wizard's rainbow. She was passing her hands back and forth above it and muttering rapidly under her breath, but the ball remained dark. Jonas had locked her in and had gone to Coral. She had been waiting for him in the parlor where tomorrow's conversational would have been held. There were plenty of bedrooms in that wing, but it was to her dead brother's that she had led him, and not by accident either, Jonas was sure. There they made love in the canopied bed Hart Thorin would never share with his Jilly. It was fierce, as it had always been, and Jonas was approaching his orgasm when the first oil derrick blew. Christ, she's something, he thought. There's never in the whole damned world been a woman like then. Two more explosions in rapid succession, and Coral froze for a moment beneath him before beginning to thrust her hips again. Sitko, she said in a hoarse, panting voice. Yarr, he growled and began to thrust with her. He had lost all interest in making love, but they had reached the point where it was impossible to stop, even under threat of death or dismemberment. 2 minutes later, he was striding, naked, toward Thorin's little lick of a balcony, his half-erect penis wagging from side to side ahead of him like some half-wit's idea of a magic wand. Coral was a step behind him, as naked as he was. "Why now?" she burst out as Jonas thrust open the balcony door. "I could have come 3 more times." Jonas ignored her. The countryside looking northwest was a moon-gilded darkness, except where the oil patch was. There he saw a fierce yellow core of light. It was spreading and brightening even as he watched, one thudding explosion after another hammered across the intervening miles. He felt a curious darkening in his mind. That feeling had been there ever since the brat Dearborn, by some febrile leap of intuition, had recognized him for who and what he was. Making love to the energetic Coral melted that feeling a little, but now, looking at the burning tangle of fire which had 5 minutes ago been the good man's oil reserves, it came back with debilitating intensity, like a swamp fever that sometimes quits the flesh but hides in the bones and never really leaves. "You're in the West," Dearborn had said. "The soul of a man such as you can never leave the West." Of course it was true, and he hadn't needed any such tit-monkey as Will Dearborn to tell him, but now that it had been said, there was a part of his mind that couldn't stop thinking about it. Fucking Will Dearborn. Where exactly was he now, him and his pair of good-mannered mates? In Avery's Calabozo? Jonas didn't think so. Not anymore. Fresh explosions ripped the night. Down below, men who had run and shouted in the wake of the early morning's assassinations were running and shouting again. "It's the biggest reaping firework that ever was," Coral said in a low voice. Before Jonas could reply, there was a hard hammering on the bedroom door. It was thrown open a second later, and Clay Reynolds came clumping across the room, wearing a pair of blue jeans and nothing else. His hair was wild, his eyes were wilder. "Bad news from town, Eldred," he said. "Dearborn and the other two in-world brats, 3 more explosions, falling almost on top of each other. From the blazing Sitko oil patch, a great red-orange fireball rose lazily into the black of night, faded, disappeared." Reynolds walked out onto the balcony and stood between them at the railing, unmindful of their nakedness. He stared at the fireball with wide, wondering eyes until it was gone. As gone as the brats. Jonas felt that curious, debilitating gloom trying to steal over him again. "How did they get away?" he asked. "Do you know? Does Avery?"
"Avery's dead. The deputy who was with him, too. 'Twas another deputy found him, Todd Bridger. Eldred, what's going on out there? What happened?"
"Oh, that's your boys," Coral said. "Didn't take them long to start their own reaping party, did it?" How much heart do they have? Jonas asked himself. It was a good question, maybe the only one that mattered. Were they now done making trouble, or just getting started? He once more wanted to be out of here, out of Seafront, out of Hambry, out of Magus. Suddenly, more than anything, he wanted to be miles and wheels and leagues away. He had bounded around his hillock, it was too late to go back, and now he felt horribly exposed. "Clay?"
"Yes, Eldred?"
But the man's eyes and his mind were still on the conflagration at Sitko. Jonas took his shoulder and turned Reynolds toward him. Jonas felt his own mind starting to pick up speed, ticking past points and details, and welcomed the feeling. That queer, dark sense of fatalism faded and disappeared.
"How many men are here?" he asked.
Reynolds frowned, thought about it.
35, he said, maybe.
"How many armed?"
"With guns?"
"No, with pea-blowers, you damned fool."
"Probably,"
Reynolds pulled his lower lip, frowning more fiercely than ever,
"probably 12. That's guns likely to work, you can."
"The big boys from the Horsemen's Association still all here?"
"I think so."
Get Lengel and Renfrew. At least you won't have to wake him up. They'll all be up, and most of them right down there.
Jonas jerked a thumb at the courtyard. Tell Renfrew to put together an advance party. Armed men. I'd like 8 or 10, but I'll take 5. Have that old woman's cart harnessed to the strongest, hardiest pony this place has got. Tell that old fuck Miguel that if the pony he chooses dies in the traces between here and Hanging Rock, he'll be using his wrinkled old balls for earplugs.
Carl Thorin barked brief, harsh laughter. Reynolds glanced at her, did a double-take at her breasts, then looked back at Jonas with an effort.
"Where's Roy?" Jonas asked.
Reynolds looked up.
"Third floor with some little serving maid? Kick him out," Jonas said. "It's his job to get the old bitch ready to ride."
"We're going?"
"Soon as we can. You and me first with Renfrew's boys and Lengel behind with the rest of the men. You just make sure Hash Renfrew's with us, Clay. That man's got sand in his craw."
"What about the horses out on the drop?"
"Never mind the ever-fucking horses!"
There was another explosion at Sitgo. Another fireball floated into the sky. Jonas couldn't see the dark clouds of smoke which must be rushing up, or smell the oil. The wind, out of the east and into the west, would be carrying both away from town.
"But just do as I say!"
Jonas now saw his priorities in clear ascending order. The horses were on the bottom. Farson could find horses damn near anywhere. Above them were the tankers gathered at Hanging Rock. They were more important than ever now because the source was gone. Lose the tankers, and the big coffin hunters could forget going home. Yet most important of all was Farson's little piece of the Wizard's Rainbow. It was the one truly irreplaceable item. If it was broken, let it be broken in the care of George Letigo, not that of Eldred Jonas.
"Get moving," he told Reynolds. "DePape rides after with Lengel's men, you with me. Go on, make it happen."
"And me?" Coral asked. He reached out and tugged her toward him. "I ain't forgot you, darling," he said.
Coral nodded and reached between his legs, oblivious of the staring Clay Reynolds.
"Aye," she said, "and I ain't forgot you."
4. They escaped Sitgo with ringing ears and slightly singed around the edges, but not really hurt. Shimi riding double behind Cuthbert and Capricoso clattering after at the end of his long lead. It was Susan who came up with the place they should go, and like most solutions, it seemed completely obvious once someone had thought of it. And so, not long after Reaping Eve had become Reaping Morn, the 5 of them came to the hut in the Bad Grass where Susan and Roland had on several occasions met to make love. Cuthbert and Alain unrolled blankets, then sat on them to examine the guns they had liberated from the sheriff's office. They had also found Bert's slingshot.
"These are hard calibers," Alain said, holding one up with the cylinder sprung and peering one-eyed down the barrel.
"If they don't throw too high or wide, Roland, I think we can do some business with them."
"I wish we had that rancher's machine gun," Cuthbert said wistfully.
"You know what Court would say about a gun like that?"
Roland asked, and Cuthbert burst out laughing. So did Alain.
"Who's Court?" Susan asked.
"The tough man Eldred Jonas only thinks he is," Alain said. "He was our teacher."
Roland suggested that they catch an hour or two of sleep. The next day was apt to be difficult. That it might also be their last was something he didn't feel he had to say.
"Alain, are you listening?"
Alain, who knew perfectly well that Roland wasn't speaking of his ears or his attention span, nodded.
"Do you hear anything?"
"Not yet."
"Keep at it."
"I will. But I can't promise anything. The touch is fluky, you know that as well as I do."
"Just keep trying."
Shimi had carefully spread 2 blankets in the corner next to his proclaimed best friend.
"He's Roland, and he's Alain. Who are you, good old Arthur Heath? Who are you, really?"
"Cuthbert's my name." He stuck out his hand. "Cuthbert Allgood. How do you do, and how do you do, and how do you do again?"
Shimi shook the offered hand, then began giggling. It was a cheerful, unexpected sound, and made them all smile. Smiling hurt Roland a little, and he guessed that if he could see his own face, he'd observe a pretty good burn from being so close to the exploding derricks.
"Cuthbert," Shimi said, giggling. "Oh, my, Cuthbert. That's a funny name. No wonder you're such a funny fellow. Cuthbert. Oh, that's a pip, a real pip."
Cuthbert smiled and nodded.
"Can I kill him now, Roland, if we don't need him any longer?"
Save him a bit, why don't you? Roland said. Then turned to Susan, his own smile fading. Will thee walk out with me a bit, Sue? I'd talk to thee. She looked up at him, trying to read his face. All right? She held out her hand. Roland took it. They walked into the moonlight together. And beneath its light, Susan felt dread take hold of her heart. 5. They walked out in silence through sweet-smelling grass that tasted good to cows and horses, even as it was expanding in their bellies, first bloating and then killing them. It was high, at least a foot taller than Roland's head, and still green as summer. Children sometimes got lost in the bad grass and died there, but Susan had never feared to be here with Roland, even when there were no sky markers to steer by. His sense of direction was uncannily perfect. "Sue, thee disobeyed me in the matter of the guns," he said at last. She looked at him, smiling, half amused and half angry. "Does thee wish to be back in thy cell, then, thee and thy friends?" "No, of course not. Such bravery." He held her close and kissed her. When he drew back, they were both breathing hard. He took her by the arms and looked into her eyes. "But thee mustn't disobey me this time." She looked at him steadily, saying nothing. "Thee knows," he said, "thee knows what I'd tell thee." "Aye, perhaps." "Say. Better you than me, maybe." "I'm to stay at the hut while you and the others go. Shimi and I are to stay." He nodded. "Will you? Will thee?" She thought of how unfamiliar and wretched Roland's gun had felt in her hand as she held it beneath the serape, of the wide, unbelieving look in Dave's eyes as the bullet she'd fired into his chest flung him backward, of how the first time she'd tried to shoot Sheriff Avery, the bullet had only succeeded in setting her own clothing afire, although he had been right there in front of her. They didn't have a gun for her unless she took one of Roland's. She couldn't use one very well in any case. And more important, she didn't want to use one. Under those circumstances, and with Shimi to think about too, it was best she just stay out of the way. Roland was waiting patiently. She nodded. "Shimi and I'll wait for thee, it's my promise." He smiled, relieved. "Now pay me back with honesty, Roland." "If I can." She looked up at the moon, shuddered at the ill-omened face she saw, and looked back at Roland. "What chance thee'll come back to me?" He thought about this very carefully, still holding to her arms. "Far better than Jonas thinks," he said at last. "We'll wait at the edge of the bad grass and should be able to mark his coming well enough." "Aye, the herd of horses I saw, he may come without the horses," Roland said, not knowing how well he had matched Jonas's thinking. "But his folk will make noise even if they come without the herd. If there's enough of them, we'll see them as well. They'll cut a line through the grass like a part in hair." Susan nodded. She had seen this many times from the drop, the mysterious parting of the bad grass as groups of men rode through it. "If they're looking for thee, Roland? If Jonas sends scouts ahead?" "I doubt he'll bother," Roland shrugged. "If they do, why, we'll kill them. Silent, if we can. Killing's what we were trained to do. We'll do it." She turned his hands over, and now she was gripping his arms instead of the other way around. She looked impatient and afraid. "He hasn't answered my question. What chance I'll see thee back?" He thought it over. "Even toss," he said at last. She closed her eyes as if struck, drew in a breath, let it out, opened her eyes again. "Bad," she said. "It may be not as bad as I thought." "And if thee doesn't come back, Shimi and I go west, as thee said before?" "Aye, to Gilead. There'll be a place of safety and respect for you there, dear, no matter what. But it's especially important that you go if you don't hear the tankers explode. Thee knows that, doesn't he?" "To warn your people, thy quartet." Roland nodded. "I'll warn them, no fear, and keep Shimi safe, too. He's as much the reason we've got this far as anything I've done." Roland was counting on Shimi for more than she knew. If he and Bert and Alain were killed, it was Shimi who would stabilize her, give her reason to go on.
"When does thee leave?" Susan asked. "Do we have time to make love?"
"We have time, but perhaps it's best we don't," he said. "It's going to be hard enough to leave thee again without, unless you really want to." His eyes half pleaded with her to say yes.
"Let's just go back and lie down a bit," she said, and took his hand.
For a moment it trembled on her lips to tell him that she was kindled with his child, but at the last moment she kept silent. There was enough for him to think about without that added mayhap, and she didn't want to pass such happy news beneath such an ugly moon. It would surely be bad luck. They walked back through high grass that was already springing together along their path. Outside the hut, he turned her toward him, put his hands on her cheeks, and softly kissed her again. "I will love thee forever, Susan," he said. "Come whatever storms." She smiled. The upward movement of her cheeks spilled a pair of tears from her eyes.
"Come whatever storms," she agreed.
She kissed him again, and they went inside. 6. The moon had begun to descend when a party of 8 rode out beneath the arch with "Come in Peace" writ upon it in the great letters. Jonas and Reynolds were in the lead. Behind them came Rhea's black wagon, drawn by a trotting pony that looked strong enough to go all night and half the next day. Jonas had wanted to give her a driver, but Rhea refused.
"Never was an animal I didn't get on with better'n any man ever could," she told him,
and that seemed to be true. The reins lay limp in her lap. The pony worked smart without them. The other 5 men consisted of Hash Renfrew, Quint, and 3 of Renfrew's best vaqueros. Coral had wanted to come as well, but Jonas had different ideas.
"If we're killed, you can go on more or less as before," he'd said. "There'll be nothing to tie you to us."
"Without ye, I'm not sure there'd be any reason to go on," she said.
"Ah, quit that schoolgirl shit. It don't become you. You'd find plenty of reasons to keep staggering down the path if you had to put your mind to it. If all goes well, as I expect it will, and ye still want to be with me, right out of here as soon as you get word of our success. There's a town west of here in the Vicastus Mountains, Ritzy. Go there on the fastest horse you can swing a leg over. You'll be there ahead of us by days, no matter how smart we're able to push along. Find a respectable inn that'll take a woman on her own, if there is such a thing in Ritzy. Wait. When we get there with the tankers, you just fall into the column at my right hand. Have you got it?"
She had it. One woman in 1,000 was Coral Thorin, sharp as Lord Satan and able to fuck like Satan's favorite harlot. Now, if things only turned out to be as simple as he'd made them sound. Jonas fell back until his horse was pacing alongside the black cart. The ball was out of its bag and lay in Rhea's lap.
"Anything?"
he asked. He both hoped and dreaded to see that deep pink pulse inside it again.
"Nay, it'll speak when it needs to, though. Count on it."
"Then what good are you, old woman?"
"You'll know when the time comes,"
Rhea said, looking at him with arrogance, and some fear as well, he was happy to see. Jonas spurred his horse back to the head of the little column. He had decided to take the ball from Rhea at the slightest sign of trouble. In truth, it had already inserted its strange, addicting sweetness into his head. He thought about that single pink pulse of light he'd seen far too much.
"Balls," he told himself. "Battle sweat's all I've got. Once this business is over, I'll be my old self again."
Nice, if true, but he had, in truth, begun to wonder. Renfrew was now riding with Clay. Jonas nudged his horse in between them. His dicky leg was aching like a bastard, another bad sign.
"Langell?" he asked Renfrew.
"Putting together a good bunch," Renfrew said. "Don't you fear Fran Langell. 30 men.
30?
got Harry's body. I told you I wanted 40. 40 at least.
Renfrew measured him with a pale-eyed glance, then winced at a particularly vicious gust of the freshening wind. He pulled his neckerchief up over his mouth and nose. The Vax riding behind had already done so.
How afraid of these three boys are you, Jonas? Afraid for both of us, I guess, since you're too stupid to know who they are or what they're capable of.
He raised his own neckerchief, then forced his voice into a more reasonable timbre. It was best he do so. He needed these bumpkins yet a while longer. Once the ball was turned over to Letigo, that might change.
Though mayhap we'll never see them. It's likely they're already 30 miles from here and riding west as fast as their horses will take 'em,
Renfrew agreed.
I'd give a crown to know how they got loose.
What does it matter, you idiot? Jonas thought, but said nothing.
As for Langill's men, they'll be the hardest boys he can lay hands on. If it comes to a fight, those 30 will fight like 60.
Jonas's eyes briefly met Clay's.
I'll believe it when I see it, Clay's brief glance said, and Jonas knew again why he had always liked this one better than Roy DePape.
How many armed?
With guns?
Maybe half.
They'll be no more than an hour behind us.
Good.
At least their back door was covered. It would have to do.
And he couldn't wait to be rid of that thrice-cursed ball.
Oh?
Whispered a sly, half-mad voice from a place much deeper than his heart.
Oh? Can't you?
Jonas ignored the voice until it stilled. Half an hour later, they turned off the road and onto the drop. Several miles ahead, moving in the wind like a silver sea, was the Badgrass. 7. Around the time that Jonas and his party were riding down the drop, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain were swinging up into their saddles. Susan and Shimi stood by the doorway to the hut, holding hands and watching them solemnly. "You'll hear the explosions when the tankers go, and smell the smoke," Roland said. "Even with the wind the wrong way, I think they'll smell it." Then, no more than an hour later, more smoke. "There," he pointed. "That'll be the brush piled in front of the canyon's mouth."
"And if we don't see those things?"
"Into the west. But thee will, Sue. I swear thee will." She stepped forward, put her hands on his thigh, and looked up at him in the latening moonlight. He bent, put his hand lightly against the back of her head, put his mouth on her mouth.
"Go thy course in safety,"
Susan said as she drew back from him.
"Aye," Shimi added suddenly, "stand and be true, all three."
He came forward himself and shyly touched Cuthbert's boot. Cuthbert reached down, took Shimi's hand, and shook it.
"Take care of her, old boy."
Shimi nodded seriously.
"I will."
"Come on," Roland said. He felt that if he looked at her solemn, upturned face again, he would cry. "Let's go." They rode slowly away from the hut. Before the grass closed behind them, hiding it from view, he looked back a final time.
"Sue, I love thee."
She smiled. It was a beautiful smile.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she said.
The next time Roland saw her, she was caught inside the wizard's glass. Eight. What Roland and his friends saw west of the Badgrass had a harsh, lonely beauty. The wind was lifting great sheets of sand across the stony desert floor. The moonlight turned these into foot-racing phantoms. At moments, Hanging Rock was visible, some 2 wheels distant, and the mouth of Eyebolt Canyon 2 wheels farther on. Sometimes both were gone, hidden by the dust. Behind them, the tall grass made a soughing, singing sound.
"How do you boys feel?" Roland asked. "All's well?"
They nodded.
"There's going to be a lot of shooting, I think."
"We'll remember the faces of our fathers," Cuthbert said.
"Yes," Roland agreed, almost absently. "We'll remember them very well."
He stretched in the saddle.
The wind's in our favor, not theirs. That's one good thing. We'll hear them coming. We must judge the size of the group, all right? They both nodded. If Jonas has still got his confidence, he'll come soon in a small party, whatever gunnies he can put together on short notice, and he'll have the ball. In that case, we'll ambush them, kill them all, and take the wizard's rainbow. Alan and Cuthbert sat quiet, listening intently. The wind gusted, and Roland clapped a hand to his hat to keep it from flying off. If he fears more trouble from us, I think he's apt to come later on, and with a bigger party of riders. If that happens, we'll let them pass. Then, if the wind is our friend and keeps up, we'll fall in behind them. Cuthbert began to grin. Oh, Roland, he said, your father would be proud. Only 14, but cozy as the devil. 15 come next moonrise, Roland said seriously. If we do it this way, we may have to kill their drogue riders. Watch my signals, all right? We're going to cross to Hanging Rock as part of their party? Alain asked. He had always been a step or two behind Cuthbert, but Roland didn't mind. Sometimes reliability was better than quickness. Is that it? If the cards fall that way, yes. If they've got the pink ball with them, you better hope it doesn't give us away, Alain said. Cuthbert looked surprised. Roland bit his lip, thinking that sometimes Alain was plenty quick. Certainly he had come up with this unpleasant little idea ahead of Bert, ahead of Roland, too. We've got a lot to hope for this morning, but we'll play our cards as they come off the top of the pack. They dismounted and sat by their horses there on the edge of the grass, saying little. Roland watched the silver clouds of dust racing each other across the desert floor and thought of Susan. He imagined them married, living in a freehold somewhere south of Gilead. By then, Farson would have been defeated, the world's strange decline reversed. A childish part of him simply assumed that making an end to John Farson would somehow see to that, and his gunslinging days would be over. Less than a year it had been since he had won the right to carry the six-shooters he wore on his hips, and to carry his father's great revolvers when Stephen Deschaine decided to pass them on, and already he was tired of them. Susan's kisses had softened his heart and quickened him somehow, had made another life possible. A better one, perhaps. One with a house and kiddies, and they're coming, Alain said, snapping Roland out of his reverie. The gunslinger stood up, rusher's reins in one fist. Cuthbert stood tensely nearby. Large party or small? Do you know? Alain stood facing southeast, hands held out with the palms up. Beyond his shoulder, Roland saw Old Star just about to slip below the horizon, only an hour until dawn then. I can't tell yet, Alain said. Can you at least tell if the ball... No, shut up, Roland, let me listen. Roland and Cuthbert stood and watched Alain anxiously, at the same time straining their ears to hear the hooves of horses, the creak of wheels, or the murmur of men on the passing wind. Time spun out. The wind, rather than dropping as Old Star disappeared and dawn approached, blew more fiercely than ever. Roland looked at Cuthbert, who had taken out his slingshot and was playing nervously with the pole. Bert raised one shoulder in a shrug. It's a small party, Alain said suddenly. Can either of you touch them? They shook their heads. No more than 10, maybe only 6. Gods, Roland murmured, and pumped a fist at the sky. He couldn't help it. And the ball? I can't touch it, Alain said. He sounded almost as though he were sleeping himself. But it's with them, don't you think? Roland did. A small party of 6 or 8, probably traveling with the ball. It was perfect. Be ready, boys, he said. We're going to take them. 9. Jonas's party made good time down the drop and into the bad grass. The guide stars were brilliant in the autumn sky, and Renfrew knew them all. He had a click line to measure between the two he called the twins, and he stopped the group briefly every 20 minutes or so to use it. Jonas hadn't the slightest doubt the old cowboy would bring them out of the tall grass pointed straight at Hanging Rock.
Then, about an hour after they'd entered the Badgrass, Quint rode up beside him.
"That old lady, she want to see you, Si. She say it's important."
"Do she now?" Jonas asked.
"Aye."
Quint lowered his voice.
"That ball she got on her lap, all glowy."
"Is that so?" "I'll tell you what, Quint, keep my old trail buddies company while I see what's what."
He dropped back until he was pacing beside the black cart. Rhea raised her face to him, and for a moment, washed as it was in the pink light, he thought it the face of a young girl.
"So," she said, "here you are, big boy. I thought you'd show up pretty smart."
She cackled, and as her face broke into its sour lines of laughter, Jonas again saw her as she really was, all but sucked dry by the thing in her lap. Then he looked down at it himself and was lost. He could feel that pink glow radiating into all the deepest passages and hollows of his mind, lighting them up in a way they'd never been lit up before. Even Coral, at her dirty busiest, couldn't light him up that way.
"You like it, don't ye?" she half laughed, half crooned. "Aye, so ye do. So would anyone. Such a pretty glam it is. But what do you see, Si Jonas?"
Leaning over, holding to the saddle horn with one hand, his long hair hanging down in a sheaf, Jonas looked deeply into the ball. At first he saw only that luscious labial pink, and then it began to draw apart. Now he saw a hut surrounded by tall grass, the sort of hut only a hermit could love. The door, it was painted appealing but still bright red, stood open. And sitting there on the stone stoop, with her hands in her lap, her blankets on the ground at her feet, and her unbound hair around her shoulders, was...
"I'll be damned," Jonas whispered. He had now leaned so far out of the saddle that he looked like a trick rider in a circus show, and his eyes seemed to have disappeared. There were only sockets of pink light where they had been. Rhea cackled delightedly.
"Aye, it's Thorin's jelly that never was. Dearborn's lover girl."
Her cackling stopped abruptly.
"Lover girl of the young proddy who killed my Ermot. And he'll pay for it, aye, so he will. Look closer, Si Jonas, look closer."